Hi, this is Richard Edelman, and you're listening to The Trust Makers.
Greetings, everyone. I am Lisa Osborne Ross, the U.S. CEO of Edelman. And today I'm delighted to be joined by Kimberlyn Leary. Kimberlyn is a senior vice president at the Urban Institute, an associate professor and lecturer at Harvard University. She is also a psychologist and a former White House advisor. Kim writes, consults, and teaches on leading teams, cross-boundary collaboration, negotiation, and conflict transformation. Kim, welcome to The Trustmakers.
Thank you, Lisa. I'm delighted to be here and to be in conversation with you.
All right, let's get right at it. There's so much to talk about. You clearly, Kim, have had a wide-ranging career, from roles in government to medicine to academia. How have you worked to advance equity throughout your career?
Well, you're right. I have been in many different spaces, but I would say that the one constant has been thinking about issues of equity, or before that, thinking of issues of disparities that we would see in healthcare, for example. And before that, thinking about the role of multicultural perspectives in education and in teaching. I would say that, you know, in my career, I've had the incredible honor and pleasure of starting in the classroom and teaching students. So being in conversation with young people who were always a little bit ahead of the rest of us in terms of their understanding of what they wanted from this nation, from our world, really, and where they were really on the cutting edge of what constituted not just equality, but equity. Later on, when I moved into more senior roles, I had a chance to champion those same values, as I know you have in your leadership roles, to talk to people in an organization about what a good DEIA practice meant, and to also help some of our colleagues for whom this was a new world and those who were urgent and demanding change figure out ways to talk to one another. But I would say that working for both the Obama and Biden administrations gave me incredible opportunity to work at scale, to look at the innovation that's happening across our nation, people who are trying experiments in order to bring communities together or to make things like procurement more open to minority and women-owned and LGBTQ-owned businesses. And now teaching mayors at the Bloomberg Center for Cities now have a chance to really talk with the mayors who know their cities are right in the center of their challenges and also right in the center of solution making. And equity is a prime concern for them.
Let me just say how happy I am that you were at all the tables where you were seated and using your voice, because it is obviously a commanding one and it's an important one. I try not to make assumptions. I know why I think equity is important, but before we talk about the research, from your perspective in the different places you sit, besides it being the right thing, why is equity important?
Well, I think we can underscore its importance for so many different reasons. The first is that when we think about the problems that exist in our world, we really do need a lot of ingenuity and creativity and experience in order to solve them. And people, based on their lived experience, tell us different things about both the problems in the world, but also potential solutions. So we've got a world full of problems. We need to make sure that we have a world full of change makers and problem solvers. And that means making sure that all those voices are in conversation. Secondly, you know, the very notion of our democracy depends on recognizing that we can be stronger together, that we can be one out of many. But if we are excluding some, as we have historically and continue to do so in so many different ways, then our democracy is not as robust as it needs to be. So for the sake of our nation, for the sake of problem solving, and for the sake of it being, as you said so correctly, the right thing to do, that's why equity is important. It's important at the very fabric of our nation.
Yeah, I love the way you talk about it. It is a threat to democracy. It is a threat to the very principles that this nation was built on. And I think one of the reasons that I was so excited about doing this year's Trust Barometer, our special report, U.S. Business and Racial Justice, was important because the data matters. People tend to make this an emotional issue that either ranges from defensiveness to defeatism. And the importance of having the data is so critical. So let's dive into the findings from our report. According to the report, 69% of respondents say that they are concerned about systemic racism and racial injustice. That's an increase from last year, up 8 points. That's true across demographics and political parties. So when we talk about, I don't use the word diversity, but for me, representation, when we talk about representation, ideological differences are incredibly important. So but this data found it to be true across racial, ethnic, gender demographics, as well as political parties. Does that sense of consensus surprise you?
In some ways it does. In other ways it doesn't. It does because it speaks to an urgent moment that we're in that people broadly recognize, and that they, over these last years of the pandemic and then George Floyd's murder and ongoing events of hyper-partisan politicking that we see, I think people recognize that this is not the way they want to live their lives. So they see that. So from that standpoint, I'm happily surprised that people recognize the challenge that we have. I think I'm more surprised by the fact that people could agree on at least a version of what the problem looks like. Often when people get together around the table, they agree at a very high level, at an abstract level. But when you get a little bit further down into the specifics, and especially the solutions or potential solutions, be they policy or organizational solutions, that's when you see people begin to bifurcate and separate. So I think what we know about leading change in organizations and systems is you have to start with what you first agree, what you first see as a common problem, knowing that that won't continue through the problem-solving process, but it's a really good place to start. So I think this data tells us that we're in a place where action is possible because enough people see enough of a problem in common.
I love your observation about a happy surprise. We don't have very many of these right now, and so a happy surprise is welcome. And what struck me, it was short of 10 points, and so I see everything that you're saying in terms of consensus, the positive nature of consensus, agreement on at least having a common base to work from, because if you don't have that, you can't go anywhere. But what do you attribute this 8-point increase in 1 year to? Like, what happened?
So this would just be purely speculation, because I don't have the data about that. But what I would say is, over this last year, we've been emerging more and more from our pandemic lockdown conditions. And people are going back to the office, at least some of them, at least some days a week. They're back in the streets with one another, shopping or going to sporting events. People are back in touch with one another. And there is online kind of a false community in a way that we're all in the same black boxes of Zoom. And then we get out in the world and we're talking more than our allotted 40 minutes on Zoom. And that's where some of the fracture lines can appear. So I think as people have gotten back in contact with one another, many people are aware of the political cycle that we're in. They're watching political campaigns just begin to step up. The rhetoric is beginning. And I think people are becoming worried and they're becoming concerned. And that, to my way of thinking, is not inappropriate at all.
No, in fact, it's a positive thing because that means you care. Concern is care. So I think that's positive. When I saw the initial cut and then the final of the results, I thought to myself, I think people could fall into one of four categories when they receive this data. One is, tell me something I didn't know. Okay. Two is, oh my God, this is horrible. I don't know where those people have been, but it was news to them. I think a third, and perhaps the most damaging, was, so what? Nothing is going to change. This sense of defeatism that I've talked about. But the fourth one was the one that fascinated me the most. And that was that people said, you know what? I thought this is what was happening in my organization. I'll share the data point with our listeners, but I feel like people were like, oh my God, affirmation. I had a sense. So the finding, one of the most stunning findings for me and I think others from the report, 60% of executives feel that their organization is making a lot of meaningful progress on addressing racism and racial inequalities in the workplace, while only 28% of mid-level and 18% of associate employees feel the same way. So you've got this significant gap from 60%. We're doing fine. Things are great. And then you've got 18% who are very, very concerned. And I think for many people, they were like, I felt that the problem was at the executive level. And this research affirmed it for me.
Well, I think it makes it clear that executives live in one world most of the time. And their early career staff in particular live in another. And with many, for instance, of the think tanks in the DC region where Urban is located, have become unionized and are working now through bargaining committees with their organizations. You know, I think they feel a sense, the early career people, that they have a new voice that they didn't have before to elevate their concerns. And I think on the opposite side, that is, hopefully we're all ultimately all going to be on the same side, but on the executive side, when it seems like you're running programs that at least have the potential to diversify your employee base, when you have commitment, say, to equity in one form or another, where you personally may believe in it, but you're not necessarily in the shoes of the earliest career folks who may have come out of a college environment where there was a different kind of dialogue about equity and values. And now they're in the work world and they're expecting some of that experience to be the same. And organizations have their histories. They're trying to, in many instances, trying to understand those histories. But the experience of being someone who's a mid-career person or an early career person can be just so very different. And now the bridge building is, for instance, in some organizations, helping more senior folks to understand what something like a microaggression means in the context of someone who's earlier in their career, and where the power differential is keenly felt by the person who's further down in the organizational chart. By the same token, I do think that some of our early career colleagues don't always understand how organizations work either, or how government works. And I'm not speaking now of any particular institution. There can be an expectation that the senior people can just change things if they wanted to. And the senior people are also aware, well, I've got to make sure the lights are on and the payroll is met. There are a lot of things I have to do in parallel with all of the equity initiatives that are also on my docket and in my portfolio. So I do think one of the good things about the unionization, and generally I personally as a citizen am in favor of unions, but I think one of the good things just that's happening is that earlier career people are understanding more about organizations. And organizations are learning more about this particular demographic and what they think of as the workplace they want to live in. And it is a workplace where they feel they are seen holistically and where they expect that equity is not just a slogan, it's lived in the actual practices of the organization, not just the words that people say, but the things that actually happen or don't happen.
I was rapidly taking notes for myself as you were speaking, but let me comment first on the workforce, because I think that that is a super interesting perspective in terms of why they see the world like this. So my children are part of that workforce, and I look at how they were raised as opposed to how I was raised, and it is their expectation. It is almost normal for them in many cases, and I think you find some of this regardless of socioeconomic demographics and mix, because their middle schools were representative, their colleges and universities were representative, their friends groups are more representative. And a really important point, Kim, emerging majorities. They are used to seeing people who are from that class in senior level positions. They're used to having teachers that look like that. They're used to having bosses. So that authority mix that you talked about. So I think when they come into the workplace and they're like, whoa, what is happening here? This is so dramatically different, which is why I think they are in many ways the best generation and will lead us to greatness. Early in my career, I was the deputy director of the Federal Glass Ceiling Commission that looked at barriers to prevent women and people of color from advancing. And at that point, and this was so many years ago, I don't want to say the number, but at that point, we said, it's all about the CEOs. And if the CEOs lead, people will follow. I now know as a CEO, that's not necessarily true. I can have a vision and I can even articulate that vision and I can explain what my expectations are, but it falls apart in the organization. And I think that level down in terms of executives and then mid-level, you know, probably senior level managers or who are in a position to make decisions, they're not making those decisions, even though me and other CEOs are like, this is important.
Well, you know, I think that's right. Our students, our kids, our nieces and nephews have grown up in many instances, is very different. It is representative. And there is a different sensibility that includes flexibilities that are just not the case for folks who are older. One part of the work that I did for the Biden administration in helping to implement the president's first executive order on equity, and then playing a small role in shaping the second executive order on equity, which was released more recently, is that I was so thrilled that both of those executive orders were smart in so many different ways, including in thinking about how change happens. So rather than just, as happens so often in too many organizations, you call upon the coalition of the willing or the coalition of the already caring about diversity and representation and equity to do the work, and everyone else can just sit back. Instead, the executive orders called on people with particular kinds of expertise to be on agency equity teams. So the data officer, the evaluation officer, someone who works with the public and has a public-facing role, and that leadership should be represented. Not leadership as the, you know, here is the vision and follow what I say, although, you know, I'm sure that happened too, but looking at, you know, the whole ecosystem and that ability of bringing people together from different levels with different levels of expertise. If you train them up in order to tolerate their differences well and to be able to navigate different opinions and sensibilities, then leverage them. Yes, absolutely.
Leverage and lean into those differences, because from that you get to what you are obviously so well equipped to solve for. And that is, well, what's the solve here? What is the solution? And you, by leaning into differences, I think you get to that. The other thing, and you touched on this, is for leaders who have to worry about their P&L and keeping the lights on and so forth. We have made progress when they realize that a good way to keep your lights on, a good way to strengthen your P&L, is to embrace representation.
You know, you're so right that when these what are challenges are also squarely in the portfolio of the executive, that and understood to be a part of what it takes in order for our organization to deliver whatever it delivers well, then you have a very different situation. And I always use, when I'm teaching, the metaphor of cybersecurity. Cybersecurity is something that we expect everybody to play a role in, right? And we actually say to people, you have to learn new things in order to make sure that you're not subject to phishing. And if you don't learn those new things, we'll shut you out of the system. It's that important, you know? And we just do it because we accept that cybersecurity is crucial to our organization. There are new things you have to learn. Everybody has to do it. And that it's a condition of keeping us robust and our systems healthy. There's a way to also draw on that narrative to bring people into conversation with one another.
I subscribe to everything that you said. We tend to look at this as additive rather than essential. It is essential to our success. It's what you said in the beginning. It is part of our democracy. A report found that a majority of executives, 53%, misunderstand the words affirmative action. Why do you think that understanding has collapsed? And what are the potential effects on companies when executives don't understand the meaning of or the reasons for affirmative action, how can they either advocate for or against it when they don't even know what it is?
I think this is a very astute and critical question. That executives have those misunderstandings about affirmative action strikes me as something to really put a pin in and to examine and more deeply interrogate. You know, in my other life as a clinical psychologist, I always think about, when do people not know something because they haven't been exposed to it? So how could they possibly know it? Versus when do people know things or they have every pathway to learn them, and somehow they still get to an understanding that doesn't reflect reality. So I wonder about that here. Is there something that's motivated about that lack of understanding? And it may have something to do with the general leaning away from history that happens. You know, we're so focused on the present, we don't read the history. And when you wade through some of the preliminary documents with the forthcoming SCOTUS case, or you think about the SCOTUS case in 2003, it's very particular what is being argued. And affirmative action is also very particular. And your findings show that people have generalized it to make it sound as though it's a simple process of simply making quotas and simply being obliged to take people into your office, into your workforce, regardless of their talent and capacity. Now, I do think there's a motivated part of that that we just have to think about, maybe not here in this particular conversation. But I think secondarily, that means that people can't, in a nuanced way, change their systems to produce greater representation and diversity. Because the law, as it's written, is about extending opportunity to people. And that can be shortcutted so that people say, okay, I have to have 10 people or one of this and one of that. And that really turns people into commodities and I think mistreats the integrity of people. And it also, I think, interferes with that project of our really fundamentally realizing our multiracial democracy.
It diminishes it. It lessens it and diminishes it in a really dangerous, dangerous way. You have held some pretty significant roles and in some pretty significant places. Because I do want people listening to this, and because I am always constantly learning and trying to improve, how have you experienced in these various roles and places effective and actionable equity practices?
So I can say that in both the Obama and Biden White Houses, walking around the halls was a joyous experience for many reasons, but because of the diversity that you would see, it really was wonderful. And even when I occasionally have a chance to visit again, you know, you see that once again. I would say, again, going back to the executive orders, which is what I spent so much time working on that I'm thinking about them. What I loved about the construction and the architecture of the executive orders is that it didn't rely on rhetoric alone. Rhetoric was the vision. You know, this is America. This is the way we want America to look. This is the way we want America to function. That vision was there. But when it came down to actually asking agencies to do the work of advancing equity or to ensure that their workforce represented America, they first had to engage in equity assessments to identify the barriers to equity. And then their action plans were closely coupled, at least that's what we all intended, closely coupled with the actions that they proposed to then implement and deliver over time. Now, the reasons that is important is that there are different barriers in different places. And so if you have a solution that you simply uniformly apply, it may not work in different settings. So it's so crucial to do the investigation work, identify the barriers, and then come up with solutions that are addressed to the barriers that you have. It's fabulous to create new mentoring programs for youth. I'm 100% in favor of that, particularly if there's a dearth of those mentoring programs in the places where it matters. But mentoring problems alone can't solve other kinds of issues. It's almost as if we're looking for just a solution we can pull off the shelf and begin to implement. And I think we can do much better than that. And the administration was trying to do just that.
I literally just said to someone, we will move forward when we stop looking for the playbook. We want an easy playbook that says if you put this peg into this hole, everything is going to be okay, without realizing that it is a complicated issue that requires a complex but not complicated solution. I want to lean into your role as a psychologist. And I will tell you that after the murder of George Floyd here in my organization, I will reveal that I said to Richard Edelman, I feel like I personally am carrying the brunt of everyone in this organization who is in pain because I am the most senior person of color here. And I felt it acutely. I felt more acutely the struggle that my colleagues who were overnight having to advise 200 to 300, 400 clients on these issues, that while they were dealing with their own personal trauma of watching George Floyd and the racial reckoning, but then having to get up and work every day 24/7 to meet client needs. And so as a psychologist, what kind of toll are you seeing? Yeah, the fight against systemic racism and racial injustice on those people who are involved in the movement, particularly women of color. And what's your advice for allies as we try to navigate all of this?
You know, so many different strands have come together over this last several years, from the pandemic and the isolation and an awareness of mental health in general, mental health challenges. And my former boss, Susan Rice, was a huge champion of looking at mental health and innovations in mental health. But also, as just as you described, so many people were suddenly now had 3 or 4 jobs, really, advising others, and then trying to also answer unanswerable questions to their children or to their nieces and nephews or to their students. And I've had a chance a couple of times to talk with some of the, you know, it's a distributed leadership network and the Black Lives Matter movement, and they have talked about the toll that it takes to be an activist. There's joy too, but the toll that it takes. And I see that toll even in our early career colleagues who tell us, yes, we need to understand the disparities that different communities experience. But when I walk into those communities to do that work, it wears on me because I know how smart and talented people are in those communities. And that's not how we're always looking at them. And that's my grandmother I'm studying. So the advice I would have is that there's a version of mental health where you do need a doctor and you need a counselor, and people should really recognize that mental health and physical health are one and the same. And just as you wouldn't power through a broken arm, you shouldn't power through depression on your own. But there's another kind of mental health that I think we can offer one another, and that has to do with recognizing other people and the challenges that they are facing and creating spaces in our organizations that honor the experience that people have when a horrible event that implicates their community takes place. It doesn't mean that people have to leave work, although some may need to, but it's about recognizing that. And it's about recognizing that we can offer one another kindness, grace, space, and we can learn in that process. So I do think that mental health is emerging as a social justice issue, as it should, because it's so necessary. And unfortunately, it remains so challenging to get the kind of professional mental health care that all of us at one time or another may potentially need.
So we will end on your call for, and my support of your call for kindness and for grace and for elegance and for education and for openness and for learning. And I could talk to you forever, but thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your partnership on this really important effort, and let's go make change.
Let's go make change. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning into The Trustmakers, an Edelman podcast in partnership with Advertising Week, where we speak with leaders and other trust builders across institutions. See you next time.